Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do as a mediator and a document preparation company. All I do is amicable divorces. So in the spirit of being the most amicable we can possibly be, I invited attorney and mediator Armony Baltazar back to the program. She's partner in the firm Hammers and Baltazar. Now, Armony was here on July 1st, and we talked about adult child support, something I had just gotten become aware of with one case, and then all of a sudden it just proliferated. So in getting to know Armony, she said to me, you know, Judy, maybe we could do an episode on mindfulness. And I said, mindfulness? Yes, I've heard the term. Yes, I would love to explore this, but you're an attorney. You're talking about mindfulness, and I thought there's an extra special reason why Armony should talk about this, and that's because I am forever trying to dispel the myth that attorneys don't care, that attorneys are just there to argue and to earn money, and that is absolutely not the truth. I have been blessed with knowing and working with some of the nicest, sweetest, and knowledgeable attorneys in Los Angeles. So, Armony, thank you for coming and thank you for thinking of this topic.
Thank you so much for having me and for being willing to do that, entertaining it. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, I think this is going to help everybody. And this is going to be part of a series on self-help, which I'm going to be doing next month. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be the month of September. Sorry about that. We're pre-recording. So, Armony, let's just start at the top. Could you please explain what mindfulness is?
Sure. Mindfulness is the process of minute by minute deliberately noticing what's happening to you physically, emotionally, and with your thoughts without any judgment. It's like an extreme version of being aware of all that's happening to you and focusing on that.
I couldn't think of anything harder. Yet. Yeah, I started practicing it just after talking to you and exploring the topic with you prior to today. You know, everything's crazy, right? COVID. We've got a very divided political environment. And due to COVID, we all work with the court system. They're having a very difficult time keeping up in the way they had to change the way they do business. So, yes, let's continue. So, just say this once again, because it was so important. Say what mindfulness is again, and then go into how do we develop it?
Okay. So, again, it's noticing, deliberately noticing, moment by moment, what's happening with you physically, emotionally, and in your thoughts, and doing it without judgment. Practicing to do it without judgment.
Not judging yourself for the way you're behaving and then anybody else that may be part of what you're thinking of.
That's right. So you mentioned how do you develop it. And, you know, you can develop it in a few ways. For example, meditation, yoga, tai chi are ways people develop it. My own journey led me to meditation. So I started learning about that. And basically, through meditation, how you would do it is you use your breath as an anchor. You focus on your breath, the in, the out. About half a second into doing this, your mind will go off. What am I having for lunch? Oh, my God, I have to call this person. I better not forget to pick that up. What am I even doing here? This is stupid. You know, all of that. What you do is you notice, and you can label that. You can say, that's a thought, and then come back to your breath. Another half second later, it happens again.
Right.
Whatever takes your attention away from the breath, make that your new attention. Bring your attention to that for a few seconds. Notice it. Label it is something that I've learned. And then gently return. So, for example, let's say in your thoughts, you're planning, you're this, you're that. Notice what you're doing. Part of the value of this is you're not letting yourself get carried away necessarily by your thoughts, because you're actually stopping to notice, oh, my head's taking me somewhere else. And label that. I'm thinking. I'm planning. And then try to come back. This also includes things like you suddenly get a bout of anxiety, okay? And you can't focus on your breath. You're feeling the anxiety. Okay, shift your attention to that. Investigate. What I'm feeling right now is, all right, I feel the gurgling in my stomach. My palms are kind of sweaty. I feel like this lump up here by my throat. Investigate it. Label it. Almost like you're a mirror. And that's the no judgment part, right? Notice it. Say what it is. Focus on it. Gently return to your breath. This feels like torture sometimes. And people are like, oh, I can't do it. I tried and I can't do it. If your experience is that, you keep wandering off and have to come, that is exactly you doing it. That is exactly what it is. Because what you're doing is you're building a muscle. How much in our world, in our lives, do we do some sort of brain training? We don't really.
No,
so,
we don't.
You know,
I agree.
This whole practice of, oh, my head is gone, or oh, there's an itch here, and all that, just everything to take you away from just this moment is the practice. That is you doing the curls, doing the exercise. That is that. And what happens when you do this is, for example, take for example, an emotion like anxiety, right? When you start labeling it, so you're sitting there, you're trying to breathe, and you get an anxious thought, you get an anxious feeling, label it. There's something in the fact that you're just sort of just labeling it.
Absolutely.
That dislodges you from your oneness with it, maybe. I mean, this monkey is gripped on you so bad that often, at least that's how it's been for me, I don't even notice that it might be something a little separate than me. So when I look at it and I say, okay, I'm feeling anxiety, and then, of course, take it to the body level, stomach, the lump in my throat, this, something about identifying it, looking at it separately with no drama, puts a little space in between that. Yeah, yeah.
It gives you control. It gives you control over what you're feeling.
It at
Doesn't
least,
it?
It's, I want to say, I know what you're saying. Control is...
Because you can succumb to anxiety,
yes,
and fear.
You can.
And we work in the field of divorce. I mean, how could
That's
you work in a field
is.
Less riddled with fear?
The issue I have with the word control is that it somehow seems like, oh, this is going to solve it and I can control it and I'm not going to have anxiety anymore. And
okay.
That's not the case.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
We're still going to have these feelings. The difference is we'll notice them and be hopefully less prone to being drawn by them. In other words, I may now have the ability to see what it is and not be led off by it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Swallowed up with it spiraling out of control.
That's right. Having these automatic reactions to it.
Right.
Some people describe this too, and I'll say it's been my experience also, that little bit of space that you give yourself is what allows you to respond to a situation rather than automatically react.
Right, right.
Right? Because
yes.
There's a little bit of room there now, and you're not slave to it. It doesn't mean it doesn't come in anymore.
Oh no, it always comes in.
It always, you're still human.
Right,
you're still human, damn it.
Two things about breathing. Now, you and I have both worked all our lives, so we didn't have the opportunity to watch Oprah on daytime TV. But when Oprah started doing her evening seminars with Eckhart Tolle, and who's the Indian, Deepak Chopra, she started getting into breathing, and she started talking about breath. and how controlling your breathing controls your heart rate, controls your blood pressure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, then I started becoming aware of that. And then just over the past year, I guess, but so since March of this year, yeah, when COVID hit us and I, like everybody, became very fearful of the future, I started doing this. Before you and I talked about mindfulness, I started forcing myself to walk slower in the office, not rush between suites or between rooms in my suite, not pull papers out quickly to do somebody else's file. I just calmed down. I was mindful about, let's just breathe. I'm just going to walk and get this, and there's going to be no hurry. Everything got done.
Yeah.
I didn't make as many mistakes because, you know, you catch yourself making mistakes when you're hyper.
Something about this, too, and you know, your concentration somehow gets better. It's like you're practicing concentration. My head's going off. I'm bringing it back.
Yes.
You know, oh, I feel this itch. Oh, I feel that. Bring it back. Bring it back. There's something in that training, too, that promotes, it increases sort of your patience.
You know, right.
I've noticed that, too. And, you know, when people talk about being present and in the moment, and I'm like, okay, this stuff is kind of starting to make sense. And it's not for no reason that some of the science, you know, the studying it, they're finding that some of the benefits are lower stress, lower anxiety, better focus, better feeling of, you know, a general sense of well-being, and even some physiological changes like boost to your immune system, things like that. It doesn't surprise me that that's what science is finding, because I've experienced some of that too. It doesn't mean that because I'm learning this and I've had these experiences that, oh, I just walk around in this, you know, wonderful state all the time. I still always have the challenges that come up. I still have things that cause me anxiety, but learning this, that's why they say it's a tool. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You can access it sometimes, yep. You know, you're sitting in traffic. You have this gut reaction to somebody cutting you off.
Yes.
And what if you remember this tool? Okay. What does this gut reaction feel like in my body? My face is feeling hot. I'm getting a little sweaty. Just for a minute, for a second, be mindful of what's happening with your body when you get upset by that. For a second. If you remember that tool, apply it. And that little bit of space is, for me anyway, what's created the difference between reacting to something and more thoughtfully responding to something.
And you can choose to be calm. It's actually a choice you can make, I have found.
I mean, I found by this learning, which is what has made me so excited about it, is that you can learn. You can learn around some things. I mean, I thought, okay, you know, my anxiety that I've had since I was a kid, probably mixed up with, you know, perfectionism,
right,
the pressure of that.
Right.
I thought, okay, this is just like kind of a life sentence. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And when I started doing this and started seeing, oh, it's a little bit less. It's just somehow just a little bit less. It was like, oh my God, it's not a life sentence. I can learn things about it. And there's also this radical concept that maybe you can learn to create your happiness. So I think when people are talking about concepts like that, they're at least in part discussing something that overlaps with mindfulness, because how often is your mental state the determinant of how your day is going or how you're feeling or things like that?
Yeah.
Just a little difference in my level of anxiety was the whole difference.
So is that what led you to this? And when? When did this metamorphosis take place?
I started learning out about it about 5 years ago, and it started because I read a book review. It's a book review of a book called 10% Happier. And it's about this guy Dan Harris, who's actually a news correspondent.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and he had an anxiety attack on TV, on Good Morning America.
Yes, yes.
So the review talked about his journey, how he found mindfulness, and how mindfulness had sort of this bad rap of being kind of this woo-woo thing. And he talked about, or at least the review mentioned, how CEOs were using it, scientists were studying it, Marines were even using it, and they were using it to increase their effectiveness, up their game, have more fulfillment in their life. And these were things that were affecting their personal life and their work life. You know, like this thing that was so, you know, weird was actually being used as a tool.
Yes.
By CEOs to up their game, even in the work environment. I was like, okay, I've heard of meditation for so long, sort of dismissed it. I think I gave it the, you know, less than one full minute try. And then I read this book. And at the end of this book, so much of it was, you know, there was a practice at the end. And that's what kind of like,
right.
Oh my goodness. And then I discovered UCLA has a mindfulness center and started taking classes there to learn more about it.
Okay. So we're talking to people going through divorce. And again, it couldn't be a more stressful experience, right?
Right.
You both litigate and you mediate. So how do you use this in your practice? And then how do you share this with your clients?
Yeah. You know, when I litigate, I used to do that more than I do now. I'm going to back it up and say mindfulness is something that once you learn it, it's something that you have for your life for any circumstance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in litigation, especially in court, there's a lot of things going on, right? It's whoever's on the witness stand. It's what's the next thing to say. It's noticing the judge's reaction. So, you know, it would cause me a lot of anxiety to try to control everything that's going on, which, of course, I cannot control. So one of the best things I got out of it that I started applying there was kind of calming that anxiety, because that, you know, everything that's going on does not help my brain think. So just kind of reducing that and being more sort of down to earth in what was going on and noticing. Let me see what was going on, process it more effectively, and also sort of think what is the next thing I have to say. Really not have all of that information that's in my head be clouded by the anxiety, and then just kind of respond appropriately. I noticed that that was really helpful to me. The reduction of the anxiety was something that helped me be more grounded and more effective.
Do you think that this like permeates the courtroom? Do you think when you are in that, your most mindfulness state, and you can control your emotions and you can reduce your anxiety, does that filter through everybody else's behavior maybe?
I mean,
or at least your client?
Yeah, you know, to some degree, yes. I mean, I don't know how much everybody takes it in, but there's no question that emotions are contagious, that very often we model what we see. So, for example, in the mediation context, who I am in that mediation very much can set the tone for what's happening. I mean, there's a really great mediation book called Bringing Peace into the Room that has not so much to do with the legal sides of the mediation, but who you are as a person and what you bring into the room, right?
So absolutely.
The amount of calm that you bring, yes, when somebody goes off, I mean, just think about, you know, a family that's having dinner and then somebody comes in and is a really pissy mood. And what does that do to the whole environment?
That's right. It changes the whole town.
You know, how contagious are emotions? For that reason, what you put out is felt, I believe. I think we all feel it. We talk about it often in terms of energy, right?
Yes.
That's exactly what that is. You can tell when you're with people and somebody's maybe calm and light, and you can tell somebody who is, let's say, quiet, but you can tell that there's tenseness You know, tension.
Okay, so let me give you an example. So about a week or so ago, I'm minding my own business, doing paperwork in my office, and I get a call from a client, and I'm filing for both of them. So the husband calls, and he's very tense and upset. We're in the middle of finishing the settlement agreement and everything. All the decisions are made, but this one aspect, spousal support, he's very upset about it. They've already made their decisions. He's well overpaid his commitment. But I guess there are conversations going on in the background with he and his soon-to-be ex-wife that I don't know anything about, obviously. So he calls very upset. And you know people like to lash out at anybody in their path when they're upset. And so I just happened to be in his path because he called me. And I started reacting in a defensive way. He caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting the call. Right. It was out of the blue. And I watched myself react without letting him finishing his sentences in a defensive way until I caught myself after a couple responses. And I said, no, I'm not going to engage this way. And I changed the tone of my voice. And I focused I listened, first of all. I did not interrupt. Yeah. I let him say whatever he needed to say so I could really process what he was saying and figure out what my response was going to be. And I changed my tone of voice. It was extremely soft. And I said, completely understand where you're coming from. Let's take it one step at a time. Changed his whole tone. You could hear him smiling with his voice. There's always a way out. Let's figure out what we need to do so that you feel good and we move forward.
Yeah. I love that. When you just catching yourself, you know, when I catch my own reactive pattern, and I mean, come on, in a divorce, when you're sitting mediating with a couple, there are many reactive, you know, there are patterns there for sure. But even seeing your own pattern, that's a big deal. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I don't think you should do any of this with the idea that you're going to control the other person somehow. It's completely not about that. You may have been exactly as you were and that person still been upset, right?
Maybe.
You can't.
Right.
I mean.
Exactly.
It's disingenuous to think kind of, oh, I'm going to do it because then the person will change. I don't think we should.
Well, no, I did it because I felt it wasn't right of me to react that way.
Right.
I needed to listen. I needed to be the calm voice in this spontaneous conversation.
And sometimes the contagion of that, you saw the result of that. That will not always be the case.
No, it won't.
You are not responsible for somebody else's reactions, right?
Right.
But what you did and what you were able to do, that's pretty cool. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. And to anybody who uses us or, you know, anybody in a very emotional situation, yes, we are human and we may react too quickly sometimes, but to be able to pull yourself back to identify, okay, this isn't going to work. I must change.
Yeah. And really you're doing that for yourself, right? It's a self-reflective process.
Yeah.
And even if that person goes completely off the handle and continues, my ability not to be ruled by my emotion at that moment. And some of those emotions are absolutely reactive. They're based on our histories, you know. That is something that it's for you. It's for you. What happens out there, what you put out there is kind of like bonus, you know, if it happens.
All right. So let's bring this back to your practice and working with people going through divorce. Somebody's in your office explaining these very difficult text messages and emails and conversations he or she is having with his or her soon-to-be ex. Do you offer any path within mindfulness in terms of how they can, not to put words in their mouth in terms of the negotiation, so to speak, or at least that's my role, I can't do that, but to show them how to better engage in the conversation so it remains calm and maybe they can get something productive done when they talk. Do you work with your clients at all like that without stepping over lines?
I mean, We do. I don't stop the mediation to, you know, practice, you know, a meditation or something like that. But I do to some degree, because I want them to understand what's going on with each other. So I will explore what's going on with the person. I want to make sure that the person is heard. Sometimes one of the skills that I've gotten, I think, from mediation is meditation is the ability to focus a little bit better and listen. And sometimes that person who's really upset is feeling like they haven't been heard. So that skill of listening and having them feel heard can sometimes result in things kind of calming down a little bit. You know what I mean? Because that blow up is a reflection of something else. And in as much as mindfulness teaches you to slow down and focus and builds that skill, then you can see that a little bit better as the mediator. And you can then discuss it. I won't step in and just do a mediation. I mean, it's not
well,
like
I'm actually thinking about when you're representing one client as counsel, not mediation. And you do have a volatile situation quite often when you have two attorneys involved. There's a need for attorneys to be involved.
Right.
And quite often it's because the communication between the two parties just isn't good enough that they can do it on their own or even engage in mediation. They actually need attorneys to speak for them, but they're also talking to one another in real life, especially if they have children.
Yeah.
They have to communicate somehow.
Right.
So how can this help people who need to co-parent?
I mean, I am not a meditation or mindfulness teacher, you know, just an ongoing student. But how they can help is, in my opinion, I mean, imagine you notice the patterns that are going on in your head. You notice the reactions, right? So in that moment of stopping, that allows you, in my opinion, not to make things worse, right? That it allows you to, well, let me back up for a second.
No, I like that, first of all. Back up, but that was good, not to make things worse.
Because I could have a conversation with my spouse, and even when you're married, right? Even you're not getting divorced.
That's right. You're just plain old married.
Right. And I have my issues, and my mindfulness teacher, Brian Shears, he's very wisely said, you know what? Divorce isn't where the issues got created. It's just the arena in which they appear, you know? So I thought that was, and that's absolutely true. So the patterns that I have, like if you raise your voice, right? It's the tone of your voice. My history, maybe the way I grew up, that means, oh my God, I've made a mistake. I'm in trouble. What's wrong? Like there's a reaction instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And if my husband comes in and says something with a louder than what I'm comfortable voice, that may not be at all what he means, but that may be exactly my reaction to, oh my God, did I do something wrong? But that's not at all what he means. That's just
stylistic.
A style or whatever it is.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Right. Without anything on your part.
Right. Stopping to notice my reaction, putting that little bit of space between me and that reaction gives me some room for some thought, some more effective evaluation versus a knee-jerk reaction.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it's that knee-jerk reaction often that will just make things go down that rabbit hole. And that's not helpful at all. So imagine you're communicating with a spouse about something and they say, you know, did you pick up the homework? And all they mean is, did you pick up the homework? And your maybe instantaneous reaction is, damn it, they're, you know, accusing me again of being a bad parent. And you might, instead of just saying yes, be like, yes, I picked up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Perfect example.
Okay. It's really little things that decide whether a communication goes okay or not okay. And when you have a pattern of these communications that are not okay, then you end up having a relationship, a whole relationship that is not okay because you have too many of those. You stopped just listening to each other for the words.
Yes.
And you have a built-in negativity. And that's another thing about divorce. There's already so much negativity. You're scared. You're worried. There's a whole bunch of wreckage. Maybe you have guilt. Maybe you're angry. You're resentful. And you have friends that want to help you through it. Bless them. And sometimes that adds to the negativity. Oh, I can't believe she did that. I cannot believe he did that. You know what I mean? That's more of it.
You need to fight harder.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Now, maybe you do. That's not the issue. The issue is that negativity and that emotion of that, to not be carried away by that is valuable because then you can look more effectively and see, do I not? At least your decision is made from a more reasoned place. You acknowledge that the feeling is there, but just having the response come from the feeling is particularly volatile. You know, it's a volatile thing to have when you're in a divorce. Also, when you're in a divorce, you're making big decisions. The calmer you can be, the better it is for you. There's a lot that's happening that's new. It's not just the changes in your life. You're also then going through this legal process that sounds so foreign. There's so much happening. If there's something that can make your experience through that a little easier, why not? You know, that's the thing that was most surprising to me is that, my God, it was right there.
What do you mean?
I just never tried.
Oh.
It is not magic. It is not anything like that. It's an exercise. It's a muscle to exercise and see what comes up for you.
No, it really is. I can tell you that I have a couple things going on in my life now. I have nothing to do with divorce. But it's a very business. I have a lot of business right now. I mean, from COVID, people are coming out of the house and filing again. And, you know, so we went from, oh, this is kind of nice. The phone's not ringing too much. In April, it'll ring again. And so it was really great to be calm in April. And then come June, people couldn't take it anymore. And the phone started ringing and I started revving up again. And coupled with, you know, everybody has a personal life, you know, so things go on in your personal life. And I found myself really feeling very anxious.
Yeah.
And then I had to say, okay, stop. And today is actually a particularly busy day. A lot of different moving parts, personal life and business life going on. And I just kept saying to myself all day, one step at a time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Let's take care of this first, then we'll go to the next thing.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to do 8 million things at one time, which we all tend to do.
I can so see how focus, increasing your focus, spills into your work. I mean, I've experienced that a little bit, and that's been really nice. I mean,
oh yeah.
Again, I lose it, I practice it, I lose it, I practice it.
Yes.
You know, but because sometimes when I have a number of things to do, I have trouble focusing on the one thing I have to do because while I'm doing that one thing, I'm thinking about the other things.
Yes.
That helps absolutely nothing. And it makes no difference whatsoever because in this moment, in this hour, this is what I need to do. And it makes no difference. And in fact, it makes it harder.
Yes.
If while I'm doing this,
yes,
I'm thinking of something else.
Exactly.
So when people talk about the benefit of being present. When athletes talk about being in a zone.
Perfect example, athletes.
I'm like, when I got some glimpses of this, I was like, oh my God, is this what these people are talking about?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Is this something that actually I can learn? It's like, yes, it is something I can learn.
You have to trust. This is what I was going through. You have to trust that it'll all get done. The day is long enough for most of it to get done. And it's that trust that calms you down too. And also, you know, I tell my clients, you don't have to answer every email and every phone call. If they're coming in with toxicity, you're not required to pick them up and answer. And then I started saying it to myself, hold on a minute. I don't get toxicity a lot. I really don't. I get people that just need questions answered, but sometimes it can be a lot. And I just say to myself, if I'm working on getting this file out, I don't have to answer the phone this second. I'll call them back before I leave the office. I'll make sure everybody right. gets taken care of either via email or phone call so they know that I'm with them.
Right. Yeah.
And it's that trust that if you calm down, if you focus and make this one thing your only thing right. this hour, everything else really will get done.
It's right. And the other part of it, too, that's been so important to me is sometimes I sit with those intentions and my mind goes off. I'll go to my phone. I'll go to the internet, whatever it is. The judgment of myself, remember how part of this is
non-judgmental.
Notice everything without judgment.
Yeah.
That's been actually a big part of my learning, too, because I realized as I was noticing, so I would sit there and I would say something judgmental to myself while I'm trying to meditate, and I'd be like, okay, that's a thought. Okay, that's that. And then at one point, you know, I've taken some classes, and one of them we were talking about how kind or not kind are we to ourselves? And there was this exercise, right, where the teacher was saying how, you know, you can give love so freely to somebody else, and we practice, yes, I love you so much. I was picturing somebody that I really loved. And then when he said, now all those good things that you're wishing for them, wish for yourself. And there was such a block there. And I thought, why? Why can I give so much kindness and not judgment to somebody else, but not to me? If you told me that you were meditating and your mind kept going back and forth and, oh, it felt like it was, I wouldn't say to you, oh, you can't do it. You're a total this, you're a total that. But when I've sat there myself and set up an expectation, ooh, I'm going to be so calm. And that never happens, okay?
Right.
And then my mind wanders and I bring it back. Instead of just wandering and coming back, I started noticing how judgmental I was to myself.
Yes.
That was a big aha for me.
Yes.
And somehow that opened up in me more empathy in general and for other people. Because what started happening is I started being nicer on myself. I don't talk to anybody as mean as I do to myself. I noticed that. I wouldn't say to anybody what I've said to myself in the mirror or what I've said to myself when I haven't been able to do one thing or another. So when I started getting easier on myself, the person who until then was the least worthy of forgiveness, the biggest judgments were always on me. So when I, the one least worthy of forgiveness in my head, started receiving the forgiveness, I started allowing myself to, yeah, I made that mistake. Yeah, I did that. When I gave myself that, that was in a way the ultimate person who could receive it. I gave empathy to me, and then it became easier to have empathy for others. Because if I can forgive me
yes.
for that, then I can see when you did something like that. I get it. I've done that too. And if I can forgive me,
yes.
then I have more room to forgive you.
Right. And in the opposite, something was happening with a company I had hired to do something for me personally just recently. And the person who was performing the service for me, I love that person. The staff was screwing everything up. It was one mistake after another. And it was causing me a lot of stress. Then I started becoming angry. And then I stopped and I said, you know what, Jude? You make mistakes too. You want to be forgiven. You have to relax. And if you are kind to these people, and I just said to them, I said, look, I'm starting to feel uncomfortable because it looks like some balls are being dropped, and I'm not here to blame. That's not my issue. I'm just trying to share with you what my reaction is. And be mindful, you know, that I'm in a sensitive situation right now, and I kind of need, what did I say to them earlier today? Oh, I just said, you know what? I need to breathe. I just needed to share with you what my experience is. I didn't want to blame them because I still need their help. So I don't want to put them off.
Mm-hmm.
But I use that to say, okay, Jude, do not blame them. Do not judge them. You'd never want to be blamed or judged. If you do something, everything's correct. Well, generally, everything's correctable. Generally.
Yeah.
But I used it in the opposite for me, and that calmed me down because I was going into this spiral of anger and fear, and I didn't want to be there.
That's that spiral. That's exactly it. That spiral hurts you the most, right? So I can understand that they made a mistake. I get it. It doesn't mean that I won't address it. I'll then see what I need to do to address it, but I'll address it more effectively. And in the meanwhile, I'm not taking that poison pill myself.
Yes.
Or at least I'm minimizing it, right? Because that negativity is the something that I'll be left with even after our conversation. I'm not going to get rid of all the negativity. I'm not there yet, at least me personally in my life. There's still things that upset me and get to me. Of course, I'm still totally human. But in as much as this learning has given me a tool to lessen it, to have some things, some emotions dislodge from me, right? Especially some of the negative ones, that's been helpful. That affects my moment-to-moment, day-to-day experience. Something may upset me in this moment, but whereas before the upscale, you know, the upset scale was 8, 9, whatever it was, it's a little bit lower now. So I don't carry it with me as much. I also kind of find that when I have a conversation with something that's, with somebody about something that's maybe I'm disappointed in or I want better performance in, not coming from the place of anger might also have them listen more. It may actually be more effective sometimes. This is in no case some kind of a cure-all that just fits all circumstances. It's a way of being that sometimes can have really great results. And even if with somebody else on the outside it doesn't, that's, again, that's not the point as I see it. It's internal.
Right. Right.
You know?
Yeah. Just me sharing how I felt without blame and just saying, so let's move on. What's the next thing we have to get done?
Yeah.
And let's have a great day. So for people going through divorce, this is a no-fault divorce date. So
right.
We don't ask people the reasons for divorce. They always come out. Whether it's in mediation, whether it's in the attorney's office, whether it's somebody on the witness stand talking about what went wrong, you know, things do come out eventually. How do you think mindfulness can help people when they go through their own self-analysis for the reasons for divorce? Because you have to process this stuff to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, maybe what it could do is sort of give you a clearer head about your part, your reactions, your part. Because, I mean, you can't, it's not that you're going to control the other person in any way, but if you pay more attention to what's going on for you, you may notice your reactive patterns that you brought to the relationship. Maybe that'll be enlightening for you. Maybe, I mean, in many ways, by breaking through some of the patterns, you can shine a light on what's actually happening for you, or what's important to you. So as far as the past, I'm not sure what you can do about the past unless you have a more effective conversation now. If it allows you to have a more effective conversation with your spouse because you'll have a more reasoned or thoughtful conversation.
Yes.
Noticing the triggers. And, you know, if there's room for that, that's wonderful. But ultimately, because this is a self-reflective process, maybe it'll help people see what their part is. You know, I know that for me, in my relationships, that's what it's done for me. I mean, I've noticed how, you know, there's a conversation that my husband and I keep having. You know how, like, people have their arguments, right?
Right.
So he and I have this repeating conversation. And one day we were about to have that conversation. And I swear to you, it's like a record. It's like the same things get said over and over again. And I stopped there for a moment. And I realized I saw myself going into that pattern. And I didn't quite know what to do about it at that time. But I knew I didn't want to repeat the record. So I stopped. I just stopped. I mean, it doesn't mean that our issue was resolved. But what happened on that day anyway is we didn't get into a big argument about what it was. And then, oh, you know, the bad feelings carry forward until you guys kind of, you know, make up and all that. But it just helped me see my part. Because if I went into that recording that I'm so used to going into, it's just going to be worse. That's not an effective communication. I didn't in that moment, in my upset, know how to then address, okay, well, what is the more effective communication? But I at least saw,
right?
I at least saw that and stopped going down that spiral in that moment.
Right. And don't you think this is super important to change the record when you're co-parenting, especially when you have small children and your relationship co-parenting is going to go on for a while? You have to modify the way you communicate with each other.
Yeah.
So that the children aren't damaged.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Right. I mean, and so much of what you're doing when you're noticing is noticing the constructs that are there, that are just kind of artificially there. And you may absolutely have this artificial overlay about who your ex is, what their attitude is. You may be right, but you may not be right every single time, right? Sometimes somebody just, like we were saying before, sometimes somebody just says something because they say it. It's not a loaded, you know, but at least you can receive it with more of an open, you know, like as an open slate, not as this predetermined thing, because that's really limiting. You're limiting your hearing of somebody. And sometimes too, I think kind of the best part of this is we often have a limited hearing of ourselves. Oh, I am like this, or I am that, or, oh, I'm this, you know, I'm the housewife, or I'm the that.
Oh my gosh, you're absolutely right about that.
And when you notice the constructs that are there, either on yourself or on a situation, when you can put room between yourself and that, and say you can even lift that or see it just as this, you know, artificial definition. When you can lift that, what then is left? Oddly, it's nothing is there. But also everything is there. That's, I think, where all of possibility is if you're not limited by your construct of, you know, your definition of yourself or of a situation. It shines a light on what are you without that definition of you? If you didn't have that reaction every time that happened, if you put a little bit of room between your mind and what's actually happening, you know, that distance, if that wasn't there, who are you? What matters to you? You have a new life. You're going through a divorce. There's so much that you're carrying. You maybe don't even see that there's more available to you. And what if this tool too, in addition to lowering your stress maybe and helping you focus, also opened up something about you? There's so much to learn. Who knows what you're going to want to do? You have another whole other life.
Divorce is a new beginning.
And I see so many people going through the process, and there's such a hopelessness. It's understandable. I understand. But there is, you're going to be okay. You're going to go through that. You're going to go through the negativity too. But I talk to clients about this when I think the time is right, you know, when the opportunity presents, because we need things to help us through. It's friends, it's exercise. This is just another thing that people are finding, science is finding, that's helpful. This kind of brain education and this kind of learning. Years and years ago, jogging was like this weird thing. You know what I mean? And we change. Our learning changes. We learn more. And this has been a learning that I've done anyway in my life that's been really interesting, and it's given me these tools to help me with things that come up. It's not going to change the things that come up. You know what I mean?
It's not going to change. No, it's not going to change, but it puts you more in control of yourself. You know you have this option that you can react in different ways if you choose, if you're mindful and if you choose.
How I handle the tragedy, the difficulty, that's the whole difference. It's still going to happen. I'm still going to feel the pain, all of that. But maybe it's about how long am I drawn off by the pain, the drama of it? How long? I mean, I'm not a medical professional. I do know, by the way, that if the pain that you have, the constructs and so forth, are something that come from you from a history that has trauma or something like that, this is not a cure-all or anything like that. Sometimes people use this in conjunction with other therapy, right? But in other circumstances, sometimes you notice and you're like, by putting a label on something, sometimes you can objectify something that in your mind maybe you held as a big drama.
Right.
And there's some freedom in actually looking at something as just, oh, it's just a feeling in my stomach. Let me try to boil down this massive anxiety that makes it seem like what I'm doing right now, like the world, you know, like everything relies on it. You know, it's life or death.
Try
and just boil it down to, oh, there's a feeling right here. And here's a feeling here. And here's my heartbeat going up. Something about objectifying it is a little freeing, honestly.
Right. And well, then it gives you the opportunity to do something about it.
And to
modify
see
it, if you can.
Or even just sometimes to see a circumstance in a different way.
Oh, absolutely.
To dislodge something that I'm stuck in. I see this person only like this. I see the situation only like that.
And isn't that the beauty of mediation? So you can have the mediator who has no skin in the game. Whatever the settlement is doesn't benefit the mediator.
Right.
It benefits the parties.
Right.
And because the mediator has a freer thought process while listening to the two parties get stuck in, well, I want this, this is fair. I want this, this is fair. Just listening to where they want to go allows the mediator to brainstorm a little bit with them. Well, wait a minute. Maybe you can both have what you want. Have you considered this?
Right.
You know, not to tell them what to do, but to free their mind.
Right.
Because they're stuck in fewer options, less creative thinking.
Right.
Because they're so fearful, so angry, so invested.
And that's a wonderful point. And imagine now that the people who are in mediation, who are getting the divorce, maybe they're doing mindfulness. Maybe they themselves come to that dislodging from, I was stuck on this and I'm seeing it different. The value of you as you're going through something, learning it yourself, is so much deeper than somebody just pointing it out to you. That helps sometimes too, and that's wonderful. But if you are trying that yourself and you see for yourself, there's just a deeper chord that's struck there.
Yeah. You know who Ken Cloak is, don't
yeah.
you?
I mean, yeah,
who
of doesn't course. Know? Like,
okay, so
I'm training. Yeah, yeah.
Ken Cloak is a modern day Buddha. And I interviewed him a few weeks ago.
He's wonderful, yeah.
And it was just lovely sitting and talking with him. I've never met a calmer human being in my life.
Isn't he wonderful? Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I have to ask him how he got there. But I can well imagine, well, we were talking about his techniques and how he gets people unstuck in the questions he asks
yeah.
and his viewpoint to get them to start thinking differently
yes.
about their situations so that they can create
yes.
more than they have been in terms of resolution. And I do have to ask Ken sometime, how did you get here?
Right.
How did you get to be that? Because when you listen to him talk, when he gives speeches, keynote speeches, it's not on topics you've never thought about, but you're amazed that he sees these other sides that you didn't even see as a mediator or as an attorney, because
yeah.
he came from being an attorney first and now he's a mediator.
Yeah, it's yeah.
You know, so I use him as my model. God, does anything ever upset this man? He's
well,
so calm.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful skill. I mean, yeah, I don't even know what to say that. That is the art of mediation and listening to what's going on.
Yes.
Asking the right questions. And the mindfulness also goes to, you'll have some difficult conversations in a mediation. There'll be things that come up that are uncomfortable. Being okay with that as well. You need to do that as well. It doesn't mean we avoid everything that's difficult. But if you can approach it from a place of, it's not a dramatic thing or anything like that, and sit with even that discomfort, sit even in the conflict and try to maintain the focus in the right direction, that's a big part of it.
Yeah. So this one mediation I had years ago was one of the best mediations ever, because we were settling the house, division of house. There were a couple pieces of property and the pension. And an equal division of each would have been one number, but the husband did not want an equal division. His division was $1,000 different. Well, in the division of a house and a pension, $1,000 is not much if there's
right.
a lot of money to go around. And I couldn't understand why he wasn't budging on this. He was an attorney first, and then he was a law professor. He was a law professor at one of the universities when he came into the office. They met at a law firm when she was a paralegal, and I think she was still a paralegal at some other law firm. So these people were smart, mm-hmm. and they understood law. So I'm sitting in the mediation, and we just got to a point where I couldn't move that $1,000 around. She didn't want to settle for anything other than 50-50,
mm-hmm.
and he was stuck on, I needed to be $1,000 less. I
mm-hmm.
said, okay, this is minor money. I said, well, let's end the mediation, and let me drive home. I do my best thinking. When I'm in the car and I'm driving home and there's something here that I'm not seeing, and maybe if I can figure out the right question to ask,
mm-hmm.
it will unlock what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah.
I got home, and this is one of the, I never, ever, ever communicate at night from home. I don't go to the email. I definitely don't make phone calls. It is my home,
mm-hmm.
and I need to clear my head. But I did email on this rare occasion a question to the husband. I said, I know this is important to you, but I don't think we asked you why this was important. Would you mind sharing why? And here's what came out. He said, well, I never really figured out why. He had to sit with himself that
mm-hmm.
night. And in the morning, I saw the email. And the reason why was he had gone off on a sabbatical from college teaching, from his professorship. Her mother had died and left her the house, her mother's house, fully paid for. So while he was on a sabbatical, she moved into the mother's house and didn't tell him she was moving into the house. And he came home to an empty house. The furniture wasn't gone. She wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Her clothes weren't there. Her mm-hmm. personal items weren't there. He was devastated and crushed, even though he knew the marriage wasn't good.
Yeah.
But she had never communicated that. He was so hurt, but he couldn't say it.
Mm-hmm.
He just was angry, and then he avoided. And then he just accepted, okay, she's living there. I'm living here. We're eventually going to file for divorce. And bingo, they did. Mm-hmm. I filed for them. Then we're in the mediation. And he said, I've just never expressed how hurt I was.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do it in anger. I was amazed. He said, I guess I'm okay now. All right. Who cares about the $1,000?
Yeah.
I never expressed that. So then I was waiting for her email to come through to say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Didn't get it. I let some hours go by the next morning. And then I contacted her and I said, did I miss an email? Did you respond? Well, should I have? Yes, he just put his heart out on the mediation table. It is time to address it. And he didn't even want to punish you. He wasn't even blaming you. He was just expressing. He separated himself from the situation and talked about what was underneath it, that space mm-hmm. you were talking about. So they went out to dinner the next night. They did not need me anymore as a mediator.
That's great.
And they told me, okay, here's how we're going to settle.
Yeah, yeah.
I love when you don't need me as a mediator.
I don't.
That for me, and anybody listening, as a good mediator, you want to set people up to finish on their own.
Isn't
then
that
you've
the best?
Done your job.
Yeah. Yeah. Listening and understanding people's positions, understanding people, why is that important to you, is such a big part of the mediation, because sometimes people are just, they present only a position. And a position is so not human. I want this much. Okay. But when you understand the why behind the position, those are where the emotions, where the feelings, and even if you disagree, you can at least usually empathize. And there's just more room there. So it's a lot more human, you know, and there's room for the discussion there. And that's really valuable. I mean, the irony of being a mediator, being a peacemaker, is that you deliberately insert yourself into conflict.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, my ability to not be carried away by my client's conflict and still remain sort of the stable person in the room who's guiding both the process and the conversation when there's a very relevant question to ask that hasn't been asked, the why.
Yes.
That, my ability to do that, I feel is better because of my, you know, constant mindfulness training and, you know, learning that tool and not just being carried away by, oh my God, you know, they yelled so much and, you know, but to be able to.
That's right.
Yeah.
We do have to separate ourselves from that level of emotion so that we can listen through it.
Yeah. I mean, I want to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can feel it without necessarily being carried away, because this is not to avoid your feelings, right? It is absolutely acknowledging the pain, whatever it is that's happening for you, but not being carried away by it, not having your decisions being made by that, or not having my actions in the room as the mediator be determined by that hurt, that upset. Certainly, it's very important for me to understand it, for my clients to know that I understand it, and to also help them understand each other. Sometimes the best results that you will get is when they come from a deeper place, because you don't want a decision that's made or a settlement that's reached based on, oh, guilt or this or that.
I just want to get it over with. Okay, fine. Take it. Just
you know,
fine.
I mean,
yeah.
People do that. The truth is people do that. And you
they
can,
do.
I mean, if they want to do that, okay, fine. You know, but the better ones, I found in my practice is when there is this kind of click of understanding and there's, okay, I understand why you want that result. I want this result. And there's, you know, something, a result that's reached in the end that acknowledges both parties' needs and each of them is a little bit more, satisfied with the results, satisfied with the process, and hopefully doesn't leave them with the kind of negativity and wreckage that, you know, litigation doesn't. In fact, you know, the opposite. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I also agree that when one person just wants to make an immediate knee-jerk decision just to get the pain over with, let's move forward, I just want to get divorced, it's going to come back.
I've
and
seen
worse.
That too.
Then you have decision-maker remorse, and then you want to do the post-judgment hearings and deal with it now because it's so much better. And how, I would like to end this with you providing for people areas where they can get help. People that teach this, books they can read, what resources can you provide, Armony?
Well, there are some free resources available out there for anybody who's interested in learning about mindfulness and even actually doing some mindful meditation exercises. One place that I've gone to for classes is UCLA has a Mindful Awareness Research Center. They offer classes all over town, but they also have a free app called UCLA Mindful. And get this app, and it's got all kinds of meditations on there, even this introduction about what is mindfulness, just kind of a step-by-step thing. Another really good resource is there's a mindfulness teacher. Her name is Tara Brach, B-R-A-C-H. And her website, tarabrach.com, has a lot of information there, both about the science of mindfulness and then guided meditations, you know, recordings to help you through to practice. Another one is the book I was telling you about, Dan Harris's 10% Happier. Right. Dan Harris also has a website called 10%.com, and it's literally written out TENPERCENT.com.
Okay.
And there too are free meditations, free resources to go to. And I like taking the classes through UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center. They have them all over town, and now they're doing them virtually. And there's also a free one. I think every Thursday, they have a free mindfulness practice that you can do virtually online. And when I'm not engaging in that, I enjoy reading books about it because it keeps me in it. You know, you can lose this skill, this tool. It's not like you exercise, suddenly your arms aren't weak when you do, you know, pull-ups and you're done. It's not, you know what I mean? It's
right.
You're doing it. So part of my exercise is also reading. So books by people like Joseph Goldstein, Tara Brach, Pema Chodron, C-H-O-D-R-O-N is her last name.
Oprah had her on. When Oprah was doing her evening seminar, she did.
Yeah. Jon Kabat-Zinn is another one. Jack Kornfield with a K. Sharon Salzberg, Norman Fisher.
Okay.
These are all authors with information, with books.
Right. And I want to say, don't be turned off if you don't like the idea of meditation, because you can do little mini meditations. You can take yourself, as we were talking, into little mini meditative states, but reading about it.
You can do that. And let me tell you, I do
important.
It. The mindfulness, you don't have to do meditation necessarily with your eyes closed. You don't even have to be sitting in any particular way.
Okay, see, people like to hear this. Keep going.
You don't. You don't need to have legs crossed, anything like that. I could be sitting right here on this chair the way I am, focus on one thing, and try to, again, focus on my breath, focus on what's happening with my body. For example, here's something else I do. If I'm driving, I will try to drive mindfully. Obviously, my eyes are open, but what does that mean? I'm feeling my hands on the steering wheel.
How tightly they're gripping or
I'm
not?
I'm feeling physically what's happening to me. I'm feeling my foot on the pedal. I feel the sun. I'm very aware of the sun on this shoulder. I'm listening. I hear the honk. I mean, in a way, the instruction is so simple. It's just notice what's actually happening in this moment. If I'm thinking, then I'm thinking. I don't need to be carried away by the thought. but I can label it at this moment in thinking. Breathing, you know, you can boil it down, down, down. You feel the hot air at your nostril? You feel how it's hot and then cool? You feel air at the back of your throat? You feel that? Do you feel the skin, your scalp? Focus on your scalp. Be very aware of the skin on your scalp right now. For example, it's what's happening to you right now, your thoughts, your emotions, and physically, without judgment.
Yes, and the thought that just came to me is we are so bombarded with information and extraneous emotions and yelling and shouting and very rough behavior in the world that just to come back to yourself and how you want to feel is the best thing ever.
You see how so many people report having the sense of peace mm-hmm. or general yeah. well-being.
Yeah.
Sometimes that calming down and just being here
yes.
right now.
Yes.
You know?
So, yeah. Armony, I would love people to be able to get in touch with you if they want mediation services, representation services, now that they know a little bit more about you and your approach to life. So how do they get in touch with you?
Oh, thank you so much. You can get in touch with me at my office. It's Hammers and Baltazar. Our phone number is 310-458-0796. Or you can email me. My email is abaltazar@hammersbaltazar.com. That's abaltazar @hammersbaltazar.com.
Thank you so much for being here. I
Thank
really
you.
Appreciated it.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. You can reach me either through my website, divorceresourceinc.com, divorceresourceinc.com, or my email address, Judy, J-U-D-Y, @constructiveuncoupling.com. I look forward to our next episode. Thank you so much for joining me.